Tonight, Gershon Baskin, founder of IPCRI, the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, the only joint Israeli-Palestinian think tank in the world. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. If you have any comments or questions on this show, drop a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. That's mail@tellsomebody.us. And we'll get to Gershon Baskin on solutions to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in just a minute, but I want to toss out a couple of things first. Big thanks to everyone who contributed during the pledge drive last week. One supporter of KKFI and this show on last week's pledge drive edition I didn't get to thank yet, Mary Lindsay, organizer of KC Move to Amend, www.kcmovetoamend.org. Thank you very much, Mary Lindsay. The podcast of last week's show with Free Press co-founder Bob McChesney on the importance of independent media has been posted. Look for links to podcasts of past editions of the show at www.tellsomebody.us or subscribe to the podcast at the iTunes Store. Three years ago, the founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, Gershon Baskin, came to the Kansas City area to speak and appeared on Tell Somebody. On Saturday, February 9th, Baskin returned to Kansas City and spoke at Abilene University. Dr. Jim Fleming, organizer of the event, introduced him.
Gershon Baskin is the founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, started in 1988, and it grew out of 10 years of his work in Jewish-Arab relations in Israel. And his bio is a little bit modest. It'll tell you that he was the executive director of the Institute for Education, or of Education for Jewish-Arab Coexistence. What it might not tell you is that he was instrumental in getting the Israeli government to develop this this institute. He has a PhD in international affairs from the University of Greenwich. He's a member of the steering committee of the Palestinian-Israeli Peace, or NGO Forum, I believe. He's on the editorial board of a journal that I just heard about, the Palestine-Israel Journal, which is published quarterly, which is available online. That's Palestine-Israeli or Israel Journal, if you want to check that. He's a member of the Israeli Council for Peace and Security. He's the recipient of numerous awards. I won't go into those right now, but it's available on GershonBaskin.com. Yeah. And he also is very involved in solar energy, which is and sustainable living, sustainable systems in the Middle East, and tells me that he's a partner in a company which operates in the Middle East, and his portfolio is Palestine and Egypt, and just got back from Egypt. But perhaps he's best known for this 2011 negotiated prisoner exchange. And I don't think there's a lot more I can say. I'd like to turn it over to Gershon. There will be time for questions. Everyone should have gotten one of these half-size yellow pamphlets on the dialogue, which will be here on Sunday, March 10th. I think it says 2 to 3:30. Yeah. And but there'll still be some time for questions this evening. So, without any further ado, Gershon.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you all for coming. Jim asked me to begin by talking a little bit about my personal journey that's brought me to the place where I am, and the work that I've done over the years and what I'm trying to do, and I would like to speak about where we are today and where we go from here today toward peace. So I will try to incorporate both a little bit of personal journey and a little bit of history and a little bit of analysis of what I believe this conflict is about and how it can be resolved and what a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict looks like, what are the challenges and difficulties, what are some of the lessons learned from the failure of the process until now. Well, I could begin my talk of my journey. I often try to think about where did my peace journey begin. I could tell you that as a 9-year-old boy, growing up in a Jewish neighborhood on Long Island, visited Williamsburg, Virginia with my family a few months before the U.S. Congress passed the Civil Rights Act, and opening up the Yellow Pages in the hotel we were looking for a restaurant, I was 9 years old, saw advertisements for restaurants that said whites only. And how I got back from my holiday in Williamsburg, Virginia, and read a book that was a bestseller at the time called Black Like Me, about a journalist who had injected himself with some pigment that changed the color of his skin, and he experienced life in America as a black person after growing up as a white person. And that was a book for me that changed my life. At 10 years old, I got involved in the civil rights movement and then the struggle against the war in Vietnam, and met my congressman and met Eugene McCarthy, who was running for president of the United States in 1968. Integrity is alive and well, and Eugene McCarthy was his campaign slogan. When I was 14 years old, we moved from a very Jewish neighborhood, where my school was 90% Jewish, a public school, to a very non-Jewish neighborhood, which was 2% Jewish. And I learned that minorities, wherever they are in the world, look for each other. And I wasn't looking, but someone, a Jewish classmate, found me and invited me to join the Zionist youth movement that he was starting in our town, Yom Judea. And I joined, not because I was a big Zionist or a big believer in what it was about, but I thought it was a good place to meet Jewish girls. So I became very active in the Zionist youth movement. And I went and spent a year in Israel between high school and college. I had actually, during that year, written to my parents saying I was going to stay in Israel and join the Israeli army and fight for Israel's survival. Then my parents came to Israel and convinced me that I should come back to America and at least finish my undergraduate education, get some sense knocked into my head. And when I did come back after that very intensive year of Zionist indoctrination in Israel, Zionist education as we called it, I was trying to absorb and understand this very intensive experience of an 18-year-old with no responsibility except to learn and experience and enjoy life. And I came to the realization that this year that I had spent in Israel, I had never talked to an Arab. Didn't meet one Arab and had a conversation with that whole year that I was in Israel. And I understood I had this huge gap of knowledge in my education. At some point, after beginning to read every book I could get my hands on and search out Palestinians and other Arabs that I could talk to, I understood that there had to be some kind of integration between my general worldview, which was a world of equality, a world of tolerance and understanding, a world of peace, and the Zionist education and background that I had. And I knew that at that point already I was going to move to Israel, because in Israel I felt at home. I felt like the place I needed to be. Even when I was 13 years old, my first journey to Israel for my bar mitzvah, this Jewish rites of passage, when we were in Israel visiting our cousins in Tel Aviv, standing on their veranda on the eve of the Sabbath, looking out at Tel Aviv, I remember, 13 years old, I remember telling my parents, I feel like I'm at home. Now, I must say that I'm not a religious person at all, so this wasn't some religious calling of God giving me a message. But it was something that fit right. I felt like I was in the right place. But I knew after this very intensive year in Israel and my intensive journey of seeking knowledge about the conflict, about the other people who were living in this land, I had to complete that knowledge, and I had to reach out to Palestinians to see what was possible in terms of a solution. In 1976, when I was a student at New York University living in Manhattan, I went with two other Jewish friends to meet with the ambassador of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, to the United Nations, and he agreed to see us after work hours. And in that meeting, I had appealed to Ambassador Terzi to recognize the state of Israel and to agree to make peace with Israel on the basis of two states for two people. In 1976, Ambassador Terzi responded to me over my dead body. He said, "We will never recognize Israel's right to exist. We will never make peace with Israel. You Jews should go back to where you came from." That was his response. But in my heart, I knew that the time would come when the Palestinian people would realize that there was no way for them to have their dream fulfilled of possession of 100% of the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea that they call Palestine and we call the land of Israel. That there had to be a realization at some time in the future that in order to live, in order to exist, there would have to be compromise, that would have to bring about a mutual recognition of each other's rights to live on that land that we each call our own. So I didn't give up hope. In planning to move to Israel and knowing that I wanted to engage politically, I knew that I needed to do two things. One was to gain credibility in the eyes of Israelis who would look at me, who did look at me, as a stupid, naive American who was coming to live in the land and tell them what to do. Many Israelis I had encountered would say to me, "You don't know them." Know that kind of sentence? "Them" meaning the Arabs. "You don't know them." So I knew that I needed to have some way to gain credibility. I also learned one of the principles I grew up with as a youngster, particularly in the Zionist youth movement, was two very important things. One, you don't talk about what you do, and then you talk about it. You live by example, not by preaching. That was a very important value that I grew up with in this Zionist youth movement, was doing. The second thing that they told us and taught us, and I believe very deeply, was that moving to Israel, for me, as part of my, what I call my Zionist vision, was not changing my address and then living the same life there that I might live here. It had to be a qualitative change in my life. Something that we Jews today call, it's very common in Jewish discourse, we call tikkun olam, fixing the world. That we have a responsibility on this planet to make this world a better place. That's our purpose of living. And for me, that became very personal. Part of my identity of who I am, this commitment to act on principle and a commitment to make the world a better place. And for me, I saw that in terms of working for peace.
Gershon Baskin speaking at Abilene University in Kansas City on February 9th. We'll hear some more excerpts from his speech later in the show, but right now let's listen to a conversation I had with him.
Gershon Baskin, welcome back to
Thank
Tell
you.
Somebody. Appreciate you taking the time. A lot of us in America, I think, are fairly ignorant about Israel-Palestine history and details of the issues, and I'd like to ask you why Americans should care about this, but let me preface, if I may, I've only done a couple of shows specifically on Israel-Palestine in the several years I've been doing this show, but it has come up on a lot of shows that weren't directly on that. For instance, I had the chance to talk to George McGovern once, and talking about the Iraq war several years ago and terrorism, and somehow he brought up that...
He was very involved in the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
Yeah, and that involved with a lot of these other issues was the need for a just solution there. And another McGovern, Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst I've had on the show a number of times, he talks about, you know, one of bin Laden's stated problems with wanting to attack the United States was Israel-Palestine justice. Dr. Shiva talked about, I was talking to her about water wars, and she somehow worked it around briefly to water and Israel control.
Yeah,
Why should Americans care?
I think that a lot of countries and a lot of people around the world use the Palestinian issue, use the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in order to deflect attention from other problems that they have in their own states, in their own communities, in their own societies. But that on the side, and that exists also, let's face it, there are societies that Bin Laden, I think, is an example, a point in case, who exploited the Palestinian issues for his own devious goals and desires of what he wanted to achieve. There is a conflict between Israel and the Palestinian people. Israel is one of the best allies of the United States in the world, one of the closest allies of the United States in the world, and yet American values and American political ideas cannot accept the idea of their ally denying the Palestinian people its right for freedom and sovereignty, independence, and peace. So the United States of America has a problem with one of its best allies, even though there's this great link between the State of Israel and the United States of America. In addition to that, the United States has other interests in the region, which are economic interest, strategic interest, energy interest, oil. The United States sees its role in securing the free flow of oil out of the Persian Gulf from Saudi Arabia and the other countries there, natural gas from Qatar and other places there. Iran is viewed as a strategic threat to the United States and the interest of the United States. And these very complex set of relations that exist within the Middle East impact America's interest and America's needs. President Obama, in his second day of office in his first term, had said very clearly that the resolution of the Israeli-Arab conflict is a U.S. national security interest. U.S. national security is at risk when the conflict continues between Israel and the Arabs. In addition to all of that, you have a very important, organized, and powerful American Jewish community in this country who wants to secure the relations between the State of Israel and the United States. The United States is a great friend to the State of Israel, and when the State of Israel is threatened in the region, America backs Israel. And that puts Israel in, that puts the United States in a position sometimes against some of its Arab allies and friends. So it's a complex issue, and the interest of the United States is to help the parties resolve the dispute so that a peaceful Middle East can emerge and an American interest will be protected in the region and the world by doing that.
I don't want to get too far off into the weeds, but just can't get out of my mind the recent confirmation hearings for Secretary of Defense nominee
Hagel.
And it seemed to me like, my sense, I don't know, is that maybe Obama told him, don't get too aggressive about defending statements he had made about the Israel lobby, which arguably might have been phrased a little better, but I think are pretty true. And he was asked a lot of, I thought, stupid questions by McCain and others. That
look, the Israel lobby is a conglomerate of both Jewish interest groups and Christian evangelical groups that support the right-wing vision of the State of Israel, or Islamic phobia advocates, and have a particular view of American power in the world and American politics. And Hagel's statements that he made in the past, both with regard to Israel and the Jewish lobby in Washington, AIPAC, and both with regard to policies concerning a possible U.S. use of military force against Iran, go against those right-wing political lobbies in Washington that are, again, represented more than the organized Jewish lobby of AIPAC and go into the evangelical community. I just heard today on one of the news programs I was listening to that groups affiliated with the Tea Party are organizing a national campaign against the Hagel appointment. So this also touches deep into the heart and to the root and to the nerves of the internal American divide between the blues and the reds in American society.
Kind of switching gears here for a minute, you spoke here tonight at Abilene University about some of your background and your youth and leading up to founding this organization. Can you Give us a little thumbnail of that.
I grew up in Long Island, New York, as a youngster at the tail end of the 1960s and discovered discrimination in the United States against black people. When I visited Virginia before the U.S. Congress had passed the Civil Rights Act, and that spurred me to read Black Like Me. It was a best-selling novel at the time, and to get engaged in the political questions of freedom and democracy in the United States, both in the Civil Rights Movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement. A little bit later in my life, toward high school, I also got involved in Jewish community, in a Zionist youth movement, and spent time in Israel, and began to integrate my basic political worldview of a world living in peace and equality and democracy, together with my Zionism and my view that I very much felt that Israel was my home. And when I decided that Israel would be my home and I would live there, then it was clear to me that within that society I would also work for democracy and equality and freedom and peace. And that's what I've been doing. And as a person who grew up very much with a view that you have to act on what you believe by doing, that's what I've done my whole life. I've created jobs for myself. Created institutions which I directed and had a role in these issues in Israeli society. That's what I continue to do, to put myself on the front lines and be engaged and involved in trying to make a difference in this world, make this world a better place, in particular make the country that I live in a better place, a peaceful place.
And you are a resident of Israel.
I'm an Israeli citizen. I've been living in Israel for 35 years. My whole adult life, basically, has been in Israel. I have three native-born Israeli children and a native-born Israeli wife, and we live in Jerusalem.
Could you tell us, the radio audience, what you told the live audience today about lobbying for a job in the Israeli education ministry, creating it,
yep,
and then how that led to founding?
When I moved to Israel, I went in the framework of a program called Interns for Peace. It was started by a Reform rabbi named Bruce Cohen, who was looking for young Jewish university graduates to go and live in Arab villages, Palestinian villages inside of Israel. And I went and joined the program and lived in a Palestinian village for 2 years and did community work there and worked with youth and leadership development that eventually led to the creation of a youth center, a community center in the village where I was living. When I was doing this work, it became very clear to me that the work for equality between the Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel was not the responsibility of volunteer groups or non-governmental organizations, but the responsibility of the government. And when I learned that there was no one in Israel responsible for actually improving the relations between the Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel, I wrote a proposal to the Israeli government that they hire me to become the first civil servant in Israel responsible for improving the relations between the Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel. And after 14 months of lobbying for the job, mostly I had to find how they were going to pay me for it, because it was a new job and there was a hiring freeze in those times for economic reasons. And I had some members of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, find for me a line in the budget so that they could hire me. And that was part of the lobbying that I did. But once I resolved the financial issue of how they could pay for me, they agreed to hire me. I worked in the Israeli Ministry of Education, and I worked together with other people to create a Department for Education for Democracy and Coexistence. I was asked by the Prime Minister's office to write a proposal for a German government foundation. I wrote a proposal to create the Institute for Education for Jewish Arab Coexistence, which I was then hired to direct. Later, 6-7 years later, I left that work and created IPCRI, the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, which is a joint Israeli-Palestinian public policy think tank aimed at resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on the basis of two states for two people.
And the governing structure, the board and all that, we talk about a bi-state solution.
Right.
A two-state solution,
yes.
You've got a two-state board.
Right. The IPCRI is a joint organization which is co-directed by an Israeli and a Palestinian. I was the Israeli co-director for 24 years. I actually resigned at the end of 2011, and together with my Palestinian colleague, I convinced him to resign as well, and we turned it over to a younger generation of leaders. and my colleague and I have become chairman of the board of directors. So we are now the volunteers who are assisting the organization by providing it with guidance and a public face. We have a joint board of directors, and there's a joint staff. There are two new directors, a young Israeli and a young Palestinian. Actually, the Palestinian is a Palestinian woman from East Jerusalem, a Muslim woman. I'd really hoped to try and find two women. I really wanted this organization to be led by two women, an Israeli woman and a Palestinian woman. I got 50% there.
You've got some pretty notable accomplishments with IPCRI since it was founded. Can you take off a couple of those?
Well, I think that we were very, very important in terms of generating some of the solutions that are still on the table for the resolution of some of the issues in conflict today. Both in putting forth proposals on how to deal with the city of Jerusalem that would become the capitals of both the state of Israel and the state of Palestine. We've done a lot of work on the issue of water and redistribution of water rights and the creation of joint management for water structures, for water sharing. We've convened an enormous amount of academic knowledge, both in Israel and Palestine, on the water issue, the water conflict, through conferences that we've done and books that we've published. IPCRI has been noted over the last years in an annual global think tank study. In 2012, IPCRI was noted as number 15 in the category of the most innovative ideas by think tanks around the world. Well, those are achievements. We've won some different prizes. The bottom line, though, is that we still haven't achieved our goal. The peace doesn't exist yet. The two-state solution hasn't materialized yet. And there is a continued need for engagement. It becomes more and more difficult to engage as we've had a 20-year failed peace process. And more people are either opposed to meeting and engaging or cynical about meeting and engaging and say, what's the purpose? It doesn't help anything. So the challenges are still there and the work to be done is still out there until we do reach an agreement. And even after we reach an agreement, we have to build cooperation between two states that will eventually live at peace.
And you mentioned something about, I think speaking about the time of the founding of IPCRI, that you came up with seven key issues. Could you talk
right,
about
that? Right. We detailed what we thought were the core issues in conflict between the Palestinians and Israelis, and focused on the idea of coming up with solutions to those core issues under the understanding that all seven of these issues had to be resolved in order for there to be an agreement. There can't be peace with a partial agreement. We need to resolve all seven issues, and they are the establishment of the state of Palestine next to Israel and determining the nature of its sovereignty, the delineation of the borders between the two states, the connection between the two Palestinian territories, West Bank and Gaza, that have Israel in between with a 26-mile separation, the future of Jerusalem, the future of the Palestinian refugees and their rights, the nature of economic relations between the two states, and the issue of water.
And water is not one that you usually hear come up much in the mainstream media. You think Israel, Palestine, you think missiles going at each other.
Yeah, it was a very big issue for a long time when we didn't have enough water and when desalination technology was still too expensive. And there were people who mistakenly said that the next war in the Middle East will be about water. That's all wrong. Water is a technical economic issue today more than anything else. And the state of Israel has, over the past 5 to 8 years, doubled the quantity of fresh water available through advanced desalination technology, which is today affordable. We desalinate a cubic meter of water that's 1,000 liters, about 1,000 quarts of water, for under a dollar. So for actually 50 cents. 50 cents is the price of desalinating a cubic meter of water. So when you can desalinate those quantities of water today, we have the largest desalination plants in the world today working in Israel. We're reversing the direction of the water flow in Israel because we used to bring water from the north to the desert in the south, and today the biggest desalination plant in Israel is in the south, and we're now pumping water from the south to the north because that's where the water is being produced. So what needs to happen in an Israeli-Palestinian agreement is an equitable redistribution of water rights so that Palestinians who don't have their fair share of water today in the future will get it.
You know, in a interview of this sort, we can't give a whole course in history of Israel as a state and all the history leading up to that, but could you Let's talk about the Palestinians for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Briefly lay out the factions in Palestine, PLO, Hamas. What's the situation?
Right, at the time of the creation of the peace process back in when the Palestinian National Movement began setting on a process of reconciling Israel's existence with their own political aspirations, a break-off faction from the Palestinian National Movement capsulized around an Islamic fundamentalist leader named Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, who founded the Hamas movement, the religious Islamic religious movement of resistance in opposition to the peace process. The mainstream Palestinian movement is under the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which brings together different Palestinian political movements and political parties that accept the notion of a secular Palestinian leadership. And then we have the Hamas, which is an Islamic fundamentalist leadership. And there's a splinter group to the Hamas of the Islamic Jihad that's even more extreme and more radical than Hamas. These two movements, Hamas and basically the national camp, we'll call it the PLO, have been fighting, have been at loggerheads with each other for years. Hamas in 2006, in elections that were held for the Palestinian parliament, which were free, open, fair, and democratic, won a victory in getting a majority of parliamentarians elected in free, democratic elections that took place. The problem is that the structure for elections that took place enabled Hamas to win a majority of members while only getting one-third of the vote. That was largely because the other political movements were not organized or disciplined, and they ran multiple lists, and their votes were split. Mm-hmm. So while the secular parties got 65% of the vote, Hamas, which was organized and disciplined and didn't even run in the elections under the title of Hamas, they ran a political party called Change and Reform. And everyone wanted change, and everyone wanted reform, and they were tired of the corruption of the period of Arafat, and they were tired of the lack of political achievements, and they voted for change. So Hamas won a victory then, and within a very short period of time, they conducted a military coup against the secular leadership and took over Gaza militarily. And there's been a split in the Palestinian House since June of 2007, where the West Bank is ruled by the PLO and Gaza Strip is ruled by Hamas.
And with that split, on top of all the other problems of realizing some sort of negotiated peace and two-state solution, how you said tonight you were optimistic.
Right, because what we need to do is we need to create a peace agreement with the Palestinians that says that the Palestinian state will be established in the West Bank and East Jerusalem as its capital in Gaza. There'll be the borders arrangements that will enable territorial swaps. And I don't want to get into all the details, but the basis is that the state will be founded in Gaza as well. But it will only be implemented in Gaza when the regime that's controlling Gaza accepts the terms of the agreement. And then let the forces of Palestinian internal pressure play out. Give the Palestinians a fair choice between the option of peace, of freedom and liberation, to be part of the Palestinian state, or to continue to be ruled under the regime of Hamas, which will deny them their freedom and liberation and being part of the Palestinian state and keep them under a regime which is not recognized by the world, which denies Israel the right to exist, which is committed to Israel's destruction and therefore is not engaged by the majority of the international community. Give the Palestinians that choice and they will make the right decision. They will overthrow the regime of Hamas or they will force Hamas to accept the agreement. One way or the other, the Palestinian people of Gaza are not going to sit out while there's a real opportunity for peace.
Mm-hmm. And we hear the term two-state solution a lot, and somebody says, I advocated two-state solution. Question one, if not a two-state solution, what? And question two, can you flesh out what you would picture this two-state solution to be like if it could ever be achieved?
Yeah, the people discuss the possibility of a one-state solution. In other words, one state existing between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, which would be a one person, one vote, a sort of American view of what would happen in Israel and Palestine. Just let everyone have the vote, and that will be the end of the conflict. But the reality, that doesn't end the conflict, that sustains the conflict. Because this is a conflict between two national groups that want a territorial expression for their identity. They want to control their destiny. They don't want to live under the power of anyone else. They don't want anyone else to control their destiny. They are fighting and willing to kill each other so that they have a piece of land they can call their own. That's what it's about. And if you remove, and the solution, therefore, is partition, is taking the land and dividing in a way that would be mutually acceptable to two, so that two sovereign states can live next to each other side by side in peace, with hopefully open borders and lots of cooperation, etc. If you remove the possibility of partition and you say the only solution is one state, then we transform this conflict into an identity conflict, where each side is going to fight the other for determining whose identity controls the territory. Then it's an all-out war. Right now, the Israelis are much stronger than the Palestinians. It'll be a massacre. It'll be another round of violence and another round of violence and another round of violence, and there'll be thousands of casualties. This is Bosnia. Bosnia became an identity conflict because it couldn't divide itself. Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, Montenegro, part of the former Yugoslavia, had national identities to their territory. They could separate and become nation states. Bosnia didn't. Bosnia had the Bosniak Muslims, the Croats, and the Serbs, and they were all mixed, so they fought each other in 4 years, killed 105,000 people, because it was an all-out war over everything. That's what we have to avoid. The two-state solution is based on the parameters that have been negotiated over the last 20 years, are the division, which might not sound equitable, but that's the realistic division, that the state of Palestine will be on 22% of the land between the Jordan River and the sea, and the state of Israel on 78% of the land. That's a state of Israel that existed in those borders prior to the June 1967 war, what's called the Six Days War. There'll be territorial swaps that will accommodate some of the realities that have developed illegal by Israel over the past 45 years of building settlements. There'll be about a 4% annexation of land from the West Bank to accommodate about 80% of the settlers, and territory will be given of equal size to the Palestinian state from land adjacent to the border, to the Palestinian. It'll be a messy border. This is not like the borders of Kansas that we're talking about, straight lines. There'll be zigzag, curly borders that will designate the parameters of each state. Jerusalem will be the capitals of both states. Jerusalem is a segregated city. The parts of Jerusalem that are Palestinian are clear. The parts of Jerusalem that are Israeli are clear. Those two states will have sovereignty based on demography in Jerusalem. And the holy places will be governed either by an international body, or they'll find some solution to govern it together, the holy places. That's more or less in broad terms what the agreement looks like.
And as you envision this, Jerusalem could be a Palestinian could freely.
Jerusalem as an urban space, in order for it to survive like any city, has to be open. We can't have like the Berlin Wall running through the city. It has to be an open city where people can move freely about the city, going from one part of the city to the other, where commerce can take place, where tourists can move, where pilgrims who are coming to pray in the city will have free and open access. That's, of course, dependent on us having security in the city. If there's no security, there's no peace. There's no security, there can be no peace in Jerusalem. So we're going to need a joint police force in Jerusalem backed by international support, a kind of multinational force assisting the parties take care of security concerns within Israel and Palestine and in Jerusalem in particular. These are all technical issues that we have solutions for.
Any just final thoughts you want to leave with our listeners and any websites?
My bottom line on this whole conflict is that this conflict is resolvable. And we're actually not so far away from a solution because it's been negotiated for so long, because there are proposals on the table, because the research has been done, because we know the answers to all the issues in conflict. And what we need is the political will of the leaders. The majority of Israelis and Palestinians will support an agreement if they believe that it's fair. And it's possible to arrive at a fair deal. We need our leaders to make the decisions. We need the help of the United States to help our leaders make a decision. And we need the United States to be there to provide bridging proposals, solutions, when the gaps need to be closed in the negotiating process. And it's all doable. We can do it. We can end this conflict. The United States has a crucial role to play. The current newly formed, or the government that's being formed in Israel, will have a crucial role to play. And President Abbas, the president of the Palestine Liberation Organization, is the partner for Israel to make peace with.
Okay, well, Gershon Baskin, thank you very much.
Gershon Baskin, www.gershonbaskin, GershonBaskin.com, on February 9, 2013. We'll be back with more excerpts from his speech after you listen to this. Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clammer. We've been hearing from Gershon Baskin, founder of IPCRI, the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information. Let's listen now to some excerpts from the speech he made recently at Abilene University in Kansas City.
So Netanyahu's perceived historic role until now with regard to the Iranians. And I think that President Obama, as he's already said, is going to tell Prime Minister Netanyahu, Iran is ours. I have already said, the United States will not allow Iran to have the bomb, and whatever needs to be done to ensure that Iran will not have the bomb, the United States is taking responsibility for leading the international community in preventing the nuclearization, the weaponization of the Iranian nuclear program. You, Mr. Netanyahu, have to focus on the Palestinians. I believe that this is the message that's going to be given to Netanyahu. Netanyahu has members who will probably be in his new government, political parties that were elected in this election, who have said that we will not join the government of Israel that does not renew negotiations with the Palestinians. This is also a new dimension. So we have these coming together of the United States president, who I believe is going to tell Netanyahu, you deal with the Palestinians, and we will provide the negotiating process with all the assistance that you need. We will provide the security guarantees. We will provide what's necessary to ensure that there's an agreement. You, Netanyahu, have to be serious about it. Now, the big question, of course, that everyone in Israel is asking, and I'm, of course, asking myself, is will he do it? The historic lesson of observing this man, Netanyahu, who completed two terms of being prime minister, is no. Remember the old poster about Richard Nixon? Those of you who remember Richard Nixon, would you buy a used car from this man? I wouldn't buy a used car from Netanyahu. I said it to some people at dinner. But he's the prime minister of Israel. He's the one who has to make the deal. We have this old adage in Israel. You can't make war without the left. You can't make peace without the right. It's very true. Netanyahu is the only leader in Israel today, the only leader in Israel today, who can deliver a peace deal with the Palestinians that will involve withdrawal from 96% of the West Bank, 4% annexation, taking care of about 80% of the settlers in exchange for equal territory inside of Israel, a political division of Jerusalem that will entail Palestinian control, sovereignty over the Palestinian parts of Jerusalem, Israeli control, sovereignty over the Israeli parts of Jerusalem, two capitals in the city of Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem, the heart of the heart of Jerusalem, either under some kind of international model that was proposed by Mr. Olmert, which included a governing body made up of the Palestinians, the Israelis, the Saudis, the Jordanians, and the Americans, or some other international model, or perhaps a subdivision of the old city of Jerusalem, whereby the Muslim, Christian, and Armenian quarters of the old city would be under Palestinian control, and the Jewish quarter under Israeli control. The Jewish holy place, the Western Wall, under Israeli control, and the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount on top, under the status quo that it has today of Muslim control. This is all workable in the context of an agreement. Can Netanyahu deliver it? I don't know. But I know that if he does, he will have 80% of the Israeli public behind him. 80% of the public. He's the only leader in Israel today who could make those concessions and not lead Israel into a civil war. He will bring the right wing. And that's why it's important that he be the one to do it. And he will have a government which is large enough to be able to do it. But I'll tell you also, this cannot be done in public diplomacy. Even when I sit and meet with President Abbas, and I do that every couple of weeks, President Abbas, the Palestinian president, says, we can't do this in public negotiations. When we negotiate in a public diplomacy process, each side is too busy with negotiating with their own public. We need to have serious negotiations that take place in back rooms, back channels, secret negotiations. We need some kind of public diplomatic process to serve as a smokescreen, to provide coverage, so that we can argue in public and we can accuse each other in public and we can have our photo ops and our trilateral meetings and ceremonies and visits to Washington. But the real negotiations will take place directly between the Israelis and the Palestinians, assisted by the United States, in private secret back channel negotiations. Now again, I ask, can Netanyahu do it? And with this, I'll conclude and we'll open up for discussion. I had the unique privilege of facilitating secret negotiations that took place between Israel and Hamas for the release of the Israeli abducted soldier Gilad Shalit, who was held in captivity in Gaza for 5 years and 4 months, which brought about the release of 1,027 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for one Israeli soldier. Over 400 of the Palestinian prisoners released had killed Israelis. Mr. Netanyahu has lectured to the entire world for decades. He's written books that you don't negotiate with terrorists. You don't give in to blackmail. Even in hostage situations, you don't do it. That's been Netanyahu's philosophy and his credo that he has advanced throughout the world for decades. And he did it. He surprised the world, he surprised the people of Israel, he surprised himself. Netanyahu took the values and principles that he has lived by, that you don't negotiate with terrorists, on one side of the scale, and as on the other side of the scale as the leader, he placed the fate of one Israeli soldier who was alive in captivity in Gaza. And he was reminded that the state of Israel has a covenant between the state and the people, which enables us to have a people's army. This credo of the state of Israel is that we don't leave anyone behind. It would have been easy for Netanyahu to say, Gilad Shalit was a soldier. He went to war, he didn't go to war, he was defending the border. He was captured, he was taken off, and he was a casualty. He died a hero. It happens all the time. The problem is that Gilad Shalit was alive, and we knew that he was alive. And Netanyahu ruled against his values and his principles in favor of alternative values and principles, and at that moment, in my mind, Netanyahu became a leader. I didn't vote for the man, I would probably never vote for him. But he became a leader on the day when he made that decision. And almost 80% of the Israeli public cheered him and that decision. And the same thing would happen if Netanyahu delivered peace to Israel. The overwhelming majority of Israelis would cheer him as a hero and a leader, and he would have his historic place in history. He would have his legacy. Can he do it? Time will tell. Should he do it? He has to do it. He has to be the leader that's going to do it. And I believe very strongly, with my heart of hearts, that there is no better partner to do it with than President Abbas, the head of the Palestine Liberation Organization. He is a man who is dedicated to bringing peace to his people, to fulfilling the dream of Palestinian statehood next to Israel, to delivering his people freedom and liberation and prosperity. I know the man very well. Every time I leave a meeting with him, it amazes me how we have so mislabeled him, delegitimized his leadership in the eyes of the Israeli people. He's the man who can deliver peace to the Palestinian people. And he's also the man who has to do it. Now we're running out of time. We're running out of time not because of the physical realities on the ground. I'd be happy to address that in a question. We're running out of time because of the time limitation that President Abbas can remain in power both by his own decision and by the decision of his own people, is limited. Let's face it, in the eyes of his people, he's a failure. He has not delivered the promise. And the people of Palestine are disillusioned by his leadership. Not because they disagree with his vision, they don't. But they're upset that he has not made good on his word. He has not delivered the promise of peace. Not because he hasn't wanted to, but because he hasn't found a partner on the Israeli side. So that's where we are today. Am I optimistic? First of all, I'm always optimistic. In case you didn't notice that. I believe that there's a new opportunity. I believe that there's a chance. It's not going to happen just by wishing for it. We have to work for it. And that means that work has to be done here by concerned Americans to tell your members of Congress and tell the President you want the United States engaged in working for peace between Israel and Palestine. And it has to happen over there by people like myself and my friends and colleagues who are pushing the system within, both in Israel and in Palestine. Thank you.
Gershon Baskin, www.gershonbaskin.com and www.ipcri.org. And a programming note, I'm going to be taking a couple of weeks off, but my old pal Mike Murphy will be filling in, so do tune into the show. Mike, of course, is the host of your Wednesday Morning Buzz, coming up tomorrow morning and every Wednesday from 6 to 8 a.m. Check it out. Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, a weekly public affairs program broadcast on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Central Time on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. If you haven't heard the show before, I hope you'll try it again. Tune in on Tuesday nights and also check out past shows. Scroll through the postings at www.tellsomebody.us, and while you're there, click on the Facebook link and like it. Once again, that's www.tellsomebody.us. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email lists or any other way you can think of. Big thanks, as always, to Niloufar Movahedi, and you might want to check out her show, Sabah, the Wind of Love, a mix of beautiful Persian music and insightful news and commentary on Iran, every Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central on KKFI. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next week on Tell Somebody.